Welcome to the Hunger for Change podcast, a space where we think outside the box, presenting the most brilliant and innovative trailblazers of the health and scientific field. I'm your host, Niklas Gustafsson, and today I feel so lucky to introduce a distinguished guest, Dr. Adil Khan, an expert and pioneer in the fields of musculoskeletal medicine, pain management, and regenerative medicine. With a foundation in medical science from the University of Ottawa, Dr. Khan's journey in medicine has led him to specialize in the innovative area of gene and cell therapies, making substantial contributions as a Canadian board-certified physician. His entrepreneurial spirit is shown through his co-founding of Salt, a company that combines fitness and technology, and his work as a chief scientific officer for Science and Humans, which redefines hormonal health in the digital age. Not to mention, his groundbreaking work with Minicircle Technology represents a leap towards the future of reversible gene therapy. From treating elite athletes and global personalities to his academic contributions, Dr. Khan's expertise not only gives back the life to those he directly treats, but also shapes the future of medical education and regenerative medicine. So let's jump straight into this fascinating conversation with Dr. Adil Khan. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
First of all, what does health mean to you?
Well, health to me is what's called a deficiency need. So what that means is people don't truly value it until they lose it. And as part of what you're doing and part of what many people are trying to do online is to empower people so that they can take care of their health from the beginning so they don't have all the issues when they're older. And we know most of health is attainable, which means that most chronic disease is preventable through lifestyle, something like 80% based off, you know, large population studies. So exactly. We know most chronic diseases are preventable, then why aren't we putting more infrastructure and investment into it? So basically, that's why I think all this social media stuff is so important, because it gives people the tools to be able to take care of their health.
Yeah, I agree. Adil, could you talk a little about your background, please? How did it all start?
Yeah, I mean, my story is pretty interesting, I guess, in the sense because I have a different perspective on medicine than most doctors. And it was pretty simple because I was a personal trainer. And being in the fitness world,
really?
I think when you're in the fitness world, you're using exercise and nutrition to not only help people fitter, but actually a lot of times you're helping them get off their blood pressure meds or helping them get off their diabetes meds. And so you can obviously see the impact lifestyle can have on someone's health. Yet during medical school, for whatever reason, we're not taught that stuff. And it always puzzled me a little bit. So I just naturally was drawn towards functional and integrative medicine, which is kind of looking at the root cause and, you know, evidence-based alternatives and not just giving prescription drugs and surgery for everything. So I was always fascinated by kind of root cause medicine. And then that led me into regenerative medicine, because regenerative medicine is this whole field, which is basically trying to repair tissue back to normal. So obviously people have probably heard of Wolverine or the whole concept of healing and regeneration. And now we're getting into this new era where we can try to actually facilitate real regeneration. And it's only, the technology is only getting better and better. So now I'm really into that field, because regenerative medicine, the simplest way for people, I like to say, is cells, signals, and scaffolds. So stem cells, signals, and scaffolds, the combination of those three is really where regenerative medicine's headed now. And we can use that to really regenerate and repair tissue. So it's pretty cool.
Very, very interesting. So how would you say that your personal approach to health and weight training and nutrition, how did that change after becoming a health professional? So you were talking about chronic pain and chronic disease. Living with chronic pain is so hard, and yet it's getting normalized. Why do you think this happens?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like, a lot of people are normalizing chronic pain because so many people are suffering with it that they're just saying, hey, it's part of getting older. I hear that all the time. People go to the doctor and the doctor will just be like, oh, you're just getting old. That's why you're tired. That's why you're having pain. But then I've had patients in their 40s. To me, being 40 is not old. And they're told that, you know what I mean? So as we know now, there's biological aging and then there's actual chronological aging.
Exactly.
So how fast is your body aging on the inside, your cells, versus what's the calendar birth date? So those are two very different things, and people age at different paces. And now we know there's interventions we can do that make a meaningful difference on the speed of aging. But But the reason I think it's becoming normalized is just because it's so prevalent and doctors don't have a good solution for it. So when doctors don't have a good solution, they just say that this is the way they rationalize it. And for me, that was not good enough. And that's why I dug deeper. And a lot of what I do is because I just wanted to help more people. Obviously, as a physician, as many doctors, we want to help people. But I think a lot of doctors get burnt out, and a lot of doctors, the system just makes them feel like it's impossible.
Right.
But I'm a testament to that it is possible if you are persistent and you try to find the whole.
Totally.
You know, you have good intentions. So we can treat. We've treated many chronic pain patients who've been suffering for decades, even, and they tried everything, and we were able to get them better with our approaches. So I don't think it's. I don't think once you understand, like, the first principles, kind of, like the root cause of why they're having chronic pain, then you can actually help them. But the problem is most doctors don't even know how to identify the root cause.
Totally. And they're trying to get rid of the symptoms more than finding the root cause, right? So when you talk about regenerative medicine, could you explain, I mean, what are the difference between the allopathic Western old school and medicine and more holistic medicine, so that our listeners understand where the difference is?
Yeah, the biggest difference. So allopathic medicine is what I went to medical school, have a doctorate in medicine. And what that is essentially learning about disease and then learning how to treat that disease by managing it. So typically when it comes to chronic disease, you're giving, if you have high cholesterol, you're giving a cholesterol lowering medication. If you have diabetes, you're giving a medication to control the blood sugar. And then if eventually things get really bad, they may need surgery or interventions. And so that's allopathic, whereas functional medicine and integrative medicine, those are two other kind of fields. Functional medicine is a concept of trying to figure out why did the body become dysfunctional in the first place and trying to restore that. And then integrative medicine is using evidence-based or scientific-based alternative solutions, such as nutrition, such as life exercise, such as nutraceuticals and other things, supplements that can be used to actually treat chronic disease. And now regenerative medicine is very interesting because regenerative medicine combines a lot of these concepts, but using cell and gene therapy and tissue engineering and gene editing. So it's kind of the next evolution because it allows us to get a lot more precise in terms of restoring the body back to normal.
What is, if we talk about regenerative medicine, what is happening today? What are the any new inventions? What is the recent news in regenerative medicine today?
Well, definitely the biggest news, and that's making, it made a few headlines for us too, is the gene therapy. The reason being, gene therapy has been around for a long time. There's something called CRISPR. And CRISPR is a gene editing technology. But the problem with CRISPR is you can have off-site targets. So meaning you can edit something that you don't want to. And obviously that can have some risk with it. So this whole idea of being able to edit the genes the way we want has been around for a while. But now it's getting more and more sophisticated. And the gene therapy platform that we have and the one that a lot of people, I would say, is getting a lot of interest is because it's not really editing your genetics. It's just introducing a new gene. It's just introducing a gene into your body to tell your body to make more of whatever gene of interest or peptide. So, for example, there's a peptide called follistatin. So follistatin is a peptide that's been around for 20 years, and it's been studied a lot because it inhibits myostatin, which is the kind of the enzyme that sets a limit on how much muscle you put on. So if people have ever seen those pictures of those big cows, they're very muscular and they're jacked. And the reason is because they have a myostatin deficiency, so they make no myostatin. So that's a genetic mutation. So we're not modifying your genome that way, but what we're doing is basically we're telling your body to make more follistatin, and when you get older, your follistatin levels decrease, similar to how your testosterone decreases. So we're just restoring your levels back to optimal. And then when we restore your levels, what it does is it increases energy, it increases strength, and it de-ages your body anywhere from, if you're 60 years old or older, on average 11 years. So it's pretty significant with one intervention. And it's not just like, biological markers. People actually feel more vitality, they have more energy,
they
just feel better. And the biggest thing, because a lot of people may say, oh, how do you know it's safe and stuff like that? Well, follistatin's been around for 20 years. And the technology that we use is called the plasmid vector, which has also been around for over 20 years. It's not, these technologies aren't new. What's new is the plasmid is able to stay in your body for 18 to 24 months with one injection. So you don't have to keep on injecting yourself. And that's the technological breakthrough. And that was discovered by our scientists that I work with their company. But even if I didn't work with them, I would be a huge fan of this stuff because it is a revolutionary technology. And the cool thing about it is that it's very inert, which means it doesn't stimulate your immune system, and there's no off-site targets of the vector. So basically all it's doing is, at a very basic level, it's just making your follistatin go back to normal. And that has a lot of good benefits for your body. And that's just one.
And this means that you could maintain your muscular mass when growing older, like as one of the reasons. I mean,
Exactly. And as I'm sure you know, muscle mass is the most important for longevity. So,
and it decreases with age quite a lot, like 1% per year or so.
Yeah, after age 30, it's like 0.5%, and then it starts accelerating quite a bit into your 60s. And so if you're older, but even if you're younger, it can be good to start when you're younger. But if you're older, you really want to be able to slow that muscle loss down. And this is the only treatment so far that can really do that to a significant benefit. And I think even if there, let's say there's some theoretical harm, I don't think there is, because as we said, this stuff has been around for a long time. But having more muscle is going to outweigh any potential downside that this treatment may have, because having more muscle is so important for your body as you age.
Right.
And the other thing follistatin does, it also decreases inflammation. So it has that benefit too. And then the next gene therapy we're doing is called Clotho. And Clotho will be coming out later this year. For those who don't know, Clotho is this amazing peptide that helps with brain focus, concentration. It can even increase people who have higher levels of, so they've done population level studies, and people who have higher levels of Clotho have higher IQ on average. So when we do our clinical trial, we're starting in a few months, we're going to see if Clotho gene therapy can increase IQ. So it should be pretty cool to see. It may make people smarter.
That's fascinating. I listened to a couple of podcasts with you, and one of them you were talking about the shift towards using cells instead of pills to address chronic diseases. How does that work?
Yeah, so stem cells, at a very basic level, are, most people have probably heard of stem cells because, you know, from umbilical cord tissue or embryonic, but stem cells in a very basic definition are cells in your body that can divide into new tissue, and they can replicate, they can self-replicate. So they have this unique ability to not only keep on growing, but they can turn into different types of tissue. But the problem is, how do we control the stem cells to do what we want? How do we actually make them send the signals we want? How do we control them and manipulate them? And so,
sorry, could you just explain to our listeners, what is a stem cell? What makes it specific?
So a stem cell is a type of cell in your body that can divide, so meaning it can self-renew, so it can replicate, and it can turn into any type of tissue.
Any type of tissue, right?
And that's what a true stem cell is. And that's called, and that's basically embryonic stem cells. But the problem with embryonic stem cells is that you have to get them from a fetus, and getting them from a fetus is obviously has ethical issues. And that's why that stuff was controversial when they were first talking about stem cells. But now we can get them from umbilical cord tissue after C-section birth. So we're not, obviously no babies are harmed. This umbilical cord tissue normally just gets thrown out anyway. So instead of throwing it out in the garbage, we're just collecting it, and then we're isolating the stem cells and growing them and manufacturing them. And then we can inject them or put them intravenously to have different benefits in the body. Now, to your question though, the problem with this, let's call this first generation stem cells, umbilical cord and all that. Now, second generation stem cells are genetically engineered in a lab. So meaning we can take a skin biopsy and we can reprogram it using something called the Yamanaka factors. And that's the cool stuff, because then it's like cellular reprogramming. It's basically where you can take any cell in your body and make it into a baby stem cell, which is kind of cool. So that means any cell in your body can become young again.
Wow.
So it's kind of like the immortal jellyfish. There's this jellyfish that can live for thousands of years. And the reason why this jellyfish can live for thousands of years is because it can make its cells young again. It's like it has the Yamanaka factors built into its DNA. It's really cool. So
could we do that? I mean, for us as humans?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what's being... So the gene therapy that we have, that's the whole... One of the things we're going to look into is can we induce those transcription factors and put them into your body and make your cells young again? So that I think will be is where a lot of the science is going now. It's like, how do we it's called cellular reprogramming. Yeah. Obviously, we're not there yet, but I think it's very reasonable in our lifetime that we'll see some incredible breakthroughs in aging using cellular reprogramming and what's called epigenetic alterations. So basically what we can do now is we can engineer a cell and make it like a customized stem cell to target a specific problem. So for example, if we want to treat Parkinson's disease, there's cells you can make specifically for Parkinson's. If you want to treat diabetes, there's cells you can make specifically for diabetes. And so this is getting more and more sophisticated. Instead of just using umbilical cord stem cells for different conditions, you can have specific cell lines for specific problems.
Hmm. Is there any specific field that you're focusing now, that you're specializing on now?
I would say, I mean, aging is obviously a big one because aging is such a complex disease. And like we were saying, if we can treat aging, we can help a lot of other chronic disease. So I would say a lot of our efforts are going towards aging only because it is so complicated. And by trying to study aging and solving that, we can treat a lot of other conditions. And so that's what the follistatin obviously is for. It's for aging. But then because it's so good for aging, it can help with so many other chronic degenerative conditions. You know, it can help people with neurodegenerative conditions, people with weakness, people with osteoarthritis, like inflammatory conditions. So it can help people with so many different illnesses because at the root of it is the same process that's causing aging.
Yeah. So the last couple of years, artificial intelligence has changed the world a lot. Is that a technology that you are integrating into your field of practice?
Yeah, no. There's two ways we're incorporating it. One is on the clinical side, which means that we're collecting data, and hopefully over time we'll have enough data sets where we can apply machine learning and better predict which patients would be best for which treatment. So that's one end of what we're doing. And then the other end is also using machine learning to train neural nets. So neural nets are these cool little things like Tesla. You know how Tesla has self-driving cars, or they're trying to make self-driving cars.
Yeah.
They still haven't succeeded yet. But the whole idea is they need enough data to train the AI so it can learn to do things. And so over time, we're going to have enough data, not only for hopefully better predicting who the best patients are for these treatments, but then we want to have enough data to also train AI to help guide physicians on how to do injections and how to, you know, select the right patients. And then I think the other component of AI that's going to be very helpful for regenerative medicine, especially, is because there's so much information out there now, and there's so much data being published with regenerative medicine, is AI just kind of being able to sift through that and then helping to kind of put everything together and being able to give us insights into what type of cell breakthroughs or drug breakthroughs potentially would be useful in regenerative medicine. And that's already starting to be used. People are using AI models. There's an AI that discovered some sort of drug, I think, recently, but I still think it has a bit of ways to go. For now, what I do, I personally use ChatGPT a lot. And you can use if you engineer the prompts and you engineer them properly, you can actually get a lot of insightful information that's been helpful for me personally for coming up with new ideas and everything.
Great. So as far as I understand, the treatments that you, like your treatments, the cost is really high. How can these treatments get more accessible and affordable to all?
Yeah, I mean, I always say this is just like any new technology, whether it was like TVs, you know, 20 years ago, plasma TVs, they used to be tens of thousands of dollars, right? And now you can get them for a few hundred dollars. And so there always has to be early adopters who are willing to pave the way for a better future, so to speak. So yes, a lot of our patients are people who can afford it, or celebrities or high net worth people. But they're paving the way for, so in a couple of years, this technology will become cheaper because these people are willing to do it. I think it's, I think in 5 years, it will be another, it'll probably be half the price of what it is now. And five years ago, it was much more expensive. So I think is the price is going to continue to come down. And I think in 10 years, this will be very affordable for almost everyone. So that's
probably,
kind of the,
right?
What's going to happen. It always happens with technology. That's just how it's more, you know, there's Moore's law, there's innovation in manufacturing. And then you can scale manufacturing more. You can make stem cells better now, more quality, and you can make more stem cells for less cost. So there's innovations happening on the back end, which will allow us to reduce the price for the patients.
Right. What would you say, Adele, is the are the challenges that you faced in advocating for functional medicine within the broader medical community? Have you noticed a tension between traditional pharmaceutical approaches and what you are doing?
Well, I think that's a loaded question. I think you and I both know there's a lot of pushback from conventional medical system. You know, even I'm sure with the work you do, right? When you're telling people you can help heal them with just nutrition, I'm sure doctors tell you that's impossible, right? So there's always going to be doctors who are, and especially in the mainstream community, because they're so used to doing things a certain way, it's disrupting an entire field, right? And so for them, it's very hard to understand. But I think the best analogy I can give you is there was something called endovascular stents, which is stents used for when people have heart disease, they can put a stent in. But before, they used to only do open heart surgery. And they used to do open heart surgery for everyone. And then when these doctors came in and saying that, oh, we can do it with stents, less invasive, less risky, the surgeons called them crazy. They're like, no, this is dangerous. You guys don't know what you're doing. This isn't proven. And all the same stuff that we're kind of going through. So I think it's just, and then eventually stents took over and stents became the mainstay of treatment and their standard of care now. And people would call you crazy if you were to do heart surgery instead of doing a stent. You know what I mean? If you can do a stent. And so it's the same kind of progression, which is that over time, these technologies, as they continue to get not only good results and more people do them, eventually people are just going to be like, okay, well, I guess you can do them now and we're accepting it. But medicine's always very slow to accept. And and medicine, especially now, is very problematic because medicine's becoming kind of like the software. When, you know, when superconductors were invented and then there was like this whole revolution in computing, that's kind of similar to what's happening now in medicine with gene therapy and cell therapy. Mm-hmm. It's becoming like software. So it's just like when we had the superconductor, that's where we are now. And so it's just exploding. It's going to go in the next 20 years. You won't even be able to imagine the stuff we can do with regenerative medicine. Like, it's hard to even fathom. And genetic engineering and cellular reprogramming and all this stuff. But it's going to move so fast that the regulatory bodies and the people in control aren't going to be able to keep up. And so they're just going to be, it's going to be similar to even crypto, where they try to, you know, discredit it and they try to say it's nonsense. Yeah. And then eventually they just, you know, all the institutions buy in, right? So I think that's why medical tourism, I think, will become more popular because a lot of the stuff you can't do in certain countries and you have to travel to go get it done.
So the gap between scientific discovery and the clinical application, usually there's a huge gap, right? What do you think, how could you adopt to shorten this gap and getting there faster to get to the patients?
Well, I think the clinical translation gap, it's like 15 to 20 years or something, which means that there could be discoveries in the science, but it takes 15 to 20 years.
Is it possible to shorten that?
It depends. I think we really have to get doctors to start educating themselves outside of just institutions, meaning honestly, a lot of them have to be willing to learn from other experts and being willing to do I don't think they have the time necessarily to do the research themselves, but then, like, you know, listen to other sources, right? You don't necessarily take my word as gospel and everything, but you can start looking into it. And then once you start looking into it and you start seeing the research, hopefully that'll show them that, hey, there is actually something to this. That's what a lot of doctors reach out to me That's kind of what happens. I get them interested in it, and then they start reading, and then they start wanting to incorporate this into their practice because they see the potential. And you know, I think some doctors, but a lot of them, unfortunately, they only go once a year to conferences, and those conferences are usually, you usually have specialists who are funded by pharmaceutical companies or have industry ties. So you're not really getting, your ongoing learning is very one dimensional. So you're not really learning from multiple sources. And I think that's the biggest thing I try to do is I still try to learn from multiple sources. I have academic sources and institutional sources, but then I also use social media and try to learn from other experts who are posting and talking about it. So I think it's good to take all your sources and really have a method on how to progress your learning. And it's almost going to take, I think it's going to take a lot of work to get doctors to be able to change the way they learn. That's it's not easy because a lot of doctors also have egos and they also think they know everything and they don't know what they don't know. So it's hard for them to even know that they're missing out on all this because they think they already know everything because they went to medical school and they had all this training and stuff.
Okay. Yeah. So what role do you believe that lifestyle interventions have? I mean, such as diet and exercise, what role should they play in medical education?
I mean, that's a fundamental cornerstone of health. If you don't have lifestyle medicine, you basically are neglecting all of majority of chronic illnesses, which are what cause the burden to society. So it's kind of a shame because I think they play a massive role, but we get no education on it. And doctors are not incentivized because they don't get paid really if they talk to you about nutrition and health. It's not compensated properly.
So how can we better integrate these elements into healthcare in general?
I've kind of given up on the medical system. So my personal recommendation is just empower yourself and you have to become your own health advocate. You have to learn and you have to basically teach yourself how to be healthy by learning from people. Oh, there's so many good resources now. Yes, there's a lot of noise out there, but you know, like when it comes to nutrition and when it comes to healthy living, there's so many good resources that are out there. And I think you just find a few of them and pick a few of them and you'll have more than enough information to be able to empower yourself. You can't rely on your doctor for this. It's a far gone conclusion. Doctors have failed us when it comes to health. And I think that's very clear with the chronic disease epidemic that we have. And so we can't rely on the medical system to fix this problem because they're not going to.
They're not going to, right?
We have to take the power into our own hands. And then we have to educate people, the masses, so that they can learn how to be healthy and live a healthy, strong and productive life. And the stuff we do, the cell and gene therapies, is just a cherry on top. But the foundation is it's the basics, right? How to eat for your body, minimally processed foods, exercise, lifting heavy weights, managing your stress, sleep, and then community, sense of meaning, purpose, having good social ties. It's just the basic
all
stuff.
All
that stuff. And so how do you actually integrate that into your lifestyle? A lot of people need a coach or need someone to help them. And I think that's making coaching more accessible is one of the things we're trying to do too. And we have a platform called Exalt, X-A-L-T. And we do virtual fitness coaching and do it at a cheaper pricing. Because I believe most people, I think the reality is a lot of people know what to do, but they have a hard time sticking to it. Yeah. So it's behavior change. And so I think a lot of people need a coach just to check in once a week and just be like, hey, how are you doing? Are you on the right track? And just that little nudge can be so helpful for people.
Yeah. Do you think that policy and regulation in shaping a healthier society could help? I mean, especially regarding processed foods and advertising?
Yeah. I mean, look, Netherlands was the first country in the world, I believe, that banned advertising of sugar and like refined foods to children. But the U.S., the lobbyists are so strong there. I can't imagine it happening anytime soon. So and even Japan, I think they banned, Japan banned a lot of those processed cereals, like Kellogg's and Frosted Flakes and all that stuff. So sugar, to me, sugar, even in Mexico.
I was about to say that you're in Mexico. Don't you have a sugar tax in Mexico?
Yeah, there's sugar tax. And then even the labels here say excessive calories, warning. And like, they don't have that in the US or Canada. Like, it's a joke. Like, even countries here, even other countries have that. So there's no warnings. It's just the lobbyists are so strong and people are.
Bigfoot is so strong and the lobbyists really powerful. That's hard.
People don't. And so that's why, again, you have to educate yourself and realize that, hey, maybe my government doesn't actually care about my health. And then once you start thinking that, then you start questioning everything and you have to think twice about the recommendations that your government's making.
Yeah. So when it comes to regenerative medicine and changing how we approach cancer treatments, could you talk about that? Could you tell us how this is like reshaping the cancer treatment?
Cancer?
Yep.
Yeah, so there's something called immunotherapy. So immunotherapy, as it suggests, is just a form of therapy that's trying to get your own immune system to fight cancer. So to understand why that's important, you have to first understand cancer. What happens in cancer? Cancer, basically, your cell gets hijacked. We don't know. We think it might be due to fungal spores, mycotoxins. But basically, your cell is called cell suppression theory, which means your cell's functions start getting suppressed and it starts dividing uncontrollably. It becomes kind of like I don't want to say necessarily zombie cell, but kind of like, it's like you have this infection in your cell and it's misbehaving. It's not listening to your body's instructions anymore. It's gone rogue. So imagine your cell has gone rogue and it's not listening to your body. And so what it does is it also becomes what's called immunoevasive, which means normally if you have a cell that's gone rogue or if you have an infection in your body, your immune system has something called immunosurveillance, which means it has these cells that go around your bloodstream and they look. They're kind of like security guards. They're looking to see if there's a problem. And if there's a problem, they're going to say, hey, they're going to arrest you and they're going to put you into jail, which is essentially eating you or putting you into the immune system and getting you processed. Mm-hmm. But cancer is very smart. And so is like Lyme disease and mold. A lot of these things are very smart. They have a way to get away from your security in your body. They know how to become immunoevasive. So the security guards don't detect them. And because they don't detect them, they can grow and they can keep doing what they want. And eventually they keep on growing. And then now all of a sudden you have cancer spreading and you have cancer cells. So how do we get your body to detect the cancer before it gets worse or better? Ideally prevention would be the best, but a lot of people aren't, you know, again, doctors don't do the blood test and they don't know how to do the blood test and the genomic sequencing and all that stuff to really give people if they're at risk of cancer. Because there are so many good tests now. There's a blood test. It's by Well 365, but it's an oncology screening blood test. It does 80 different blood biomarkers. And it just from blood tests, it can give you such an accurate picture of if you have cancer developing in your body. And let's just say you don't have cancer, but you have maybe some elevated markers, then you can at least start to do interventions that are going to prevent it, right?
Mm.
As opposed to waiting for cancer to happen, which is what we do, right? We just wait. You're not looking at the problem before it develops into full-blown cancer. So that's why I think first there's a testing problem. And then for us, okay, let's say a patient comes to us with cancer, we're going to look at their micronutrient status. We're going to look at kind of all the potential root drivers as to why they're having the cancer. And then we have interventions such as there's something called exercise with oxygen therapy, EWOT, which, funny enough, just exercise alone with oxygen helps to boost your natural immune system and can help to kill cancer cells. And then we can combine that with immunotherapy, which is essentially we can take something called natural killer cells from donors, which are natural killers, as the name suggests. They're like little soldiers. They're soldiers that can kill cancer cells. But what we do is we infuse them through your body intravenously, and we can combine that with something called dendritic cells, which are kind of the general or the general who kind of guides the soldiers on where to go. And so the general is the dendritic cells. He's telling the soldiers, okay, go here and kill these cells. They don't belong here. So we can do this form of immunotherapy, which is basically building the armamentarium, like kind of like your defense systems to tell them what to do and fight the cancer. And this is actually something I learned in Japan. Japanese have been doing this for 10 years, where they use immunotherapy to treat cancer. But again, in the US and in many parts of the world, this stuff is not even on the radar.
Hmm. Fascinating. So if we talk about your expertise on fecal matter. Is fecal matter transplant, right?
I think that's going to scare people. They're going to be like, fecal matter.
Because I listened to you talking about the transplants, and that was so fascinating. Could you explain what it is to our audience, please?
I'm sure your audience is very familiar with the gut and why it's so important. But gut dysbiosis, which is essentially one of the hallmarks of aging, which means it's one of the root causes as to why our bodies age. And what that means is there's an imbalance in good bacteria to bad bacteria. Mm. So what we want to do is we want to restore the good bacteria, because the good bacteria help to regulate so many different metabolic pathways. And they also regulate even mood, because there's so many serotonin receptors. So there's so many different things, and inflammation and autoimmunity. There's so many different things that the gut's involved in. And so if we can keep your gut healthy as long as possible, that's going to have a good and impactful benefit on your health and longevity. But the problem with probiotics is they're transitory, which means they don't actually repopulate the gut. So most of them don't actually stay there and actually transplant new microbes. Because why are you taking a probiotic? When a patient takes a probiotic, they're taking it because they're trying to put in good bacteria, right? But the good bacteria aren't actually staying there. So it's not actually doing anything. So what we have now is we have this technology where you can have capsules similar to probiotics, except they're transplanting microbes into your gut. So they're actually staying there. And yes, they are derived from fecal matter, but there's no feces in there. We're just isolating the good bacteria, and we're dry freezing it, and we're lyophilizing it, and we're putting it into these capsules. And then you can just eat these capsules, and they're going to repopulate good gut bacteria.
Mm, I see. So when we talk about C-section births, I don't know much about this, but I understand that there is the child's microbiome is very important. Could you expand on the actions that could help to correct this imbalance early on, and possibly prevent immune dysfunctions later on in life?
Yeah, no, we know C-section babies have a higher risk of allergy, asthma, autoimmune conditions. And there was a professor who, Blazer, who's one of the top infectious disease doctors who studied the gut very thoroughly. And he said that he also wrote a book called Missing Microbes. But he wrote about how every 1% or every dose of antibiotic that you take as a child increases your risk of autoimmunity by 1%. And some kids get like 20, 30, and some gets dozens and dozens because they have ear infections or they have tonsil infections. So we know how important the gut is at a developing age for later down the road issues. So to your point, what can we do if people were C-section or if they had lots of antibiotics? So if you're C-section, I mean, immediately, if you're baby, I would, put them in the vaginal, the fluids. You can take that on a cloth and you can just rub it on their face. That's the easiest thing to do.
That's easy.
But let's just say your baby is already older now and you can't do that. Then honestly, the best is FMT. We're going to have FMT for toddlers as well and for children. I'm going to be giving it to my own child because my baby had a...
Sorry, what is FMT? What is that?
The fecal microbial transplant. Okay. So we're going to create a children version too.
Yeah.
So you can take it if your kid is 2 or older. And the reason we're going to do that is because a lot of children, when you're developing, it's actually important if you've had C-section, if you've had antibiotics as a kid, I think you need to repopulate the gut with good bacteria.
Yeah.
So, and we know probiotics aren't going to really do that. If you eat lots of fiber and fermented food, I think that's can be helpful. But I think to have a very, again, long-term impact, I think FMT is the best way to do that.
All right. So let's make a jump here from what you just talked about and go into depression. What are the fundamental principles of what causes depression, and how do you approach this from your from your point of view?
Yeah, no, I think if you go to your typical doctor, I guess they would say depression is caused by a chemical imbalance. They'll say that you don't have enough serotonin and therefore or enough dopamine. So we're going to give you this pill and it's going to help you to increase serotonin or increase dopamine and that'll make you feel better. Mm. But that's not how depression works. That's maybe 1/5 of how depression works, but most of depression is based in three other main issues. One is neuroinflammation, which is chronic inflammation in the brain, which can happen for a variety of reasons, because of stress, because of obviously there's things in people's lives that can trigger that. But also
gluten intolerance.
Yeah, exactly. Food is a huge one. And then also toxins and the environment. And then there's also the gut brain access, right? And so we already talked about the gut and how important that is. And that's why we're actually using FMT to as part of our treatment for people who have severe depression, because we're trying to treat the root cause. And then the other component is your central nervous system. So this is probably the most important, which people are starting to talk about now, which is essentially if people have unresolved emotional trauma or some sort of childhood trauma, or even trauma as an adult, but sometimes they don't realize there's a form of trauma. And this, your body, there's a really good book, it's called The Body Keeps the Score. And so your central nervous system remembers. So your nervous system keeps the score, so to speak. And that trauma is in your body, and it's in the nervous system, and that nervous system communicates with your immune system, and then that can lead to chronic inflammation and what's called dysregulated autonomic nervous system, which means you get hyper aroused, you can be in fight or flight mode all the time, you can have more cortisol being released, and you can't relax properly either. So it's like your autonomic nervous system is all messed up. And so what we do is we try to reset the nervous system. So the way we do that is our vagus nerve injection, which has gotten a lot of popularity because I've done it for many military people, but many people with anxiety, panic attacks, depression. And it's honestly, it can be so life-changing for people who have severe anxiety or have a history of trauma, because the trauma, it's like your body can't let go. So by doing this nervous system reset, we use exosomes and peptides, and then it basically helps to reprogram the nervous system. It essentially lets your body to let go and allows healing to occur a lot easier. So you can even, it makes therapy more effective. But for some people, just the injection on its own can be life-changing, because they have such a hyper-aroused sympathetic overdrive where their fight or flight system, which is like the one that, when you get adrenaline rush, that's the sympathetic system. That system becomes, a lot of people with mental health issues, becomes overdrive. And so this just calms that down and kind of relaxes it.
Yeah. So you're based in Mexico, right?
Well, I work all over the world, but I work in Europe sometimes too, in London. But London, you can't do stem cells, so we can only do certain things there. But then we also Switzerland occasionally, and then Dubai, and then also Tokyo and Japan. Yeah.
All right. And what are your future plans? Are you opening up new clinics somewhere?
Yeah. Well, we were talking before it started, potentially in Spain.
That's great news.
Yeah. So hopefully. We're looking into it. If not Spain, definitely somewhere. If it could be Luxembourg or Greece, but definitely in Europe somewhere. So we'll have a clinic there hopefully sometime next year. But I know a lot of people want these things to be more accessible, and that's part of the reason why we're opening up clinics, just to make these things more accessible. And there's a lot of people suffering out there who need help and have tried everything, and they don't know what their options are. So so the plans are to continue to build clinics, but then also to develop innovative technologies that are going to help reach more people.
Great. So Adele, that was a pleasure talking to you. Do you have any future projects that you want to share with us?
I think the ones that, this is just a side note, but the cosmetic stuff is pretty interesting too, because a lot of people are used to doing Botox and fillers, but now with regenerative medicine, we can start using stem cells and natural scaffolds to regenerate tissue and make it fuller. And I think it's so much, again, this is the beginning, but I think in 10 years, it'll take over Botox, because Botox is just a toxin that paralyzes your skin. And over time, it actually weakens your muscles. So you want to always think about, why is your skin aging? It's aging because the mitochondria, the inflammation, all the same kind of things, right? So by injecting stem cells, we're actually targeting those hallmarks of aging. So slowing down skin aging.
Wow. Sounds really interesting. So you say about 10 years or so?
Well, we're already doing it now, but I'm saying it's going to become more mainstream. 10 years. Yeah, 10 but years. Right. we're already doing it. And, this is something I learned in Japan, because the Japanese and South Koreans are the best when it comes to skincare. And they've been doing this procedure for 10 years. And you do one procedure on the face, and it lasts for 2 to 3 years, So it's much longer lasting than Botox.
So where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on Instagram at dr.akhan, K-H-A-N. And I know a lot of people want to see me. It may be impossible to see me, but I do have other doctors on my team. Our website is eterna.health, just like eternal, but without an L, .health. And you can just click on there and book an appointment if you need some help, or if you just need some guidance on like what to do or where to go. And I know there's a lot of people out there who are falling through the cracks of the medical system and not sure where to go, you know? So we're here to help them.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me. And hopefully I'll see you in Spain one day.
Exactly. Thank you so much for listening to the Hunger for Change podcast. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I also wanted to take a moment to talk about Naturally, my brand of healthy food products. At Naturally, we are on a mission to change the world through what we eat. This is why we worked so hard to make products that are delicious and also good for you. They're all gluten-free, have no refined sugars, no sweeteners, and no additives. My personal favorites are the cheesy snacks, chocolates, and cacao hazelnut spread. We also have cookies, granolas, nut bars, nut butters, and protein powders, as well as many cool snacks to be released soon. At the moment, Naturally is only available in Europe. However, we're working to expand to other continents, so stay tuned. If you're in Spain, you can head over to our website, naturally.com, and it will take you to our online store. And if you're in Italy, Portugal, Germany, Poland, France, the Netherlands, or in Sweden, you can find them on Amazon. Search for Naturally. I will leave you all these links in the description anyway, so that you can find them. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.